All right, well, welcome to this event, an educators webinar, a professional development opportunity in association with our online course that's going on this week and next week. And the course itself is the Integrated Life and Earth Sciences in the Context of the Polar Regions. We're focusing on work done by Dr. Steve Okunin and Lisa Seff, who is a polar trek teacher that's also online here. Steve's going to share a lot of his work with us this afternoon or evening, wherever you may be. And we'll hear a little bit more from Lisa next week on how she uses polar science in her classroom. So before we get too far into our webinar here, we're going to change slides. You should be seeing slides changing in the middle of your screen. If it's not changing, go ahead and type something in the chat box so I know, and we'll try and address that. But you should have a slide right now that says Blackboard Collaborate and gives you some instructions on how to use this platform. So again, slides should be showing up in the middle. If you're interested in asking a question live, you click Talk to be able to speak and then unclick it again to finish talking. If you do have a question, you can raise your hand with a small icon right above the participant list, and there's all kinds of little features there you can use. There is the list of participants of folks who have joined us today, and below that on the left is the chat box where you can certainly put in questions and tell us a little bit about yourselves. And at this point, we've got a nice small group here, so maybe we'll go down the list and let people say who they are, where they are, and if you happen to have anybody else participating with you. But it looks like Alex is typing right now. But Alex, if your microphone works, you're welcome to introduce yourself. All right, she put in the chat box that she's from Memphis, Tennessee. Carol, I know your mic is working, so go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Carol Scott, and I'm also in Fairbanks, Alaska, absolutely loving the warm temperatures, I must admit. I have been teaching high school and most recently 12 years of middle school, 7th and 8th grade science here in Fairbanks. This year, however, I am actually on leave of absence. I'm looking to get some field science programs going for students. So pretty excited to be taking this class, though. I really am into integrated science. So looking forward to this. Thanks.
Perfect, Carol. Thanks. And Jennifer, I don't know if your microphone is working now. Looks like you're typing at the moment. But go ahead and try and use your mic. Or OK, it's not working. She's coming in from New York. Thanks, Jennifer. Julia West is just joining us. So, Julia, you're welcome to introduce yourself if your mic is working.
There, it's been a while. I was trying to figure this out. I'm Julia. I'm in northern New York, and I teach high school science for homeschooled kids through distance learning for a school called Oak Meadow School. And I've been tuning into these, taking some courses, and just want to see what's happening.
Thanks, Julia. Perfect. And Justin, if your mic is working, you're welcome to introduce yourself.
Hey, everyone. I'm Justin Moody. I'm an upper school photography teacher in Mexico City. And I'm always looking for ways to introduce cross-curricular units into my classroom. So here I am, excited for the webinar.
Perfect. Thanks, Justin. Lisa, you could introduce yourself.
Yes, hi. So I'm Lisa Seff, and I was a polar trek teacher a year ago with, I can't believe it's been a year ago with Steve and Dr. Karen Ashen from Woodsville Oceanographic and Dr. Robert Campbell out of University of Rhode Island. And we were studying the oceanographic conditions of the bowhead whale habitat out of Bear, Alaska. And I'm from Springs, New York. I teach middle school at a pre-K through 8 school in Springs. And we're a diverse community. We're about 52% Hispanic. And I love the school, and I love the science. It was a great experience and definitely completely changed the way I teach.
Thanks, Lisa. Steve, I'll let you introduce yourself in a little bit. I'm going to turn it over to Turtle. If you have your microphone working, you can press the talk button to introduce yourself and press it again when you're done. All right, Turtle, it looks like we're not hearing you at the moment, but you are welcome to send in your information in the chat box. Let us know where you're from and what you're up to. That'd be great. And we did have Joanna sign in. Joanna, if your microphone is working, you can press the talk button above the participant list. And if not, you can type into the chat box where you are and who you might be teaching and why you might be interested in this webinar. All right, thanks, Joanna. We'll look for you in the chat box there. I think that's everybody. Janet wrote in and said that she is listening in from the car with a bunch of kids, so we will let her keep doing that safely without introducing herself. But we're going to move on here to a little bit about what Polar Trek is. We're hosting this class with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Polar Trek is a professional development experience for K-12 teachers to head out on research expeditions to the Arctic and Antarctic. So that's how we are associated with Steve and Lisa and this project. And we are in the middle of looking to select another group of teachers for the coming year. So we're in that process now and hope to have projects out in the Arctic and Antarctic next year. So again, this class is a part of our larger Polar Trek program. You guys are great at using the chat box and the talk button for asking questions. But again, during the presentation, go ahead and ask questions in the chat box, or if you have a question you want to ask live, just raise your hand, and I'm sure that'll be fine. So those are our quick introductions and a little bit about this platform and what we're getting into. So at this point, I am going to turn it over to Steve, and this should be Steve's first slide.
Hello, Steve Oakman, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Actually, I'm about 500 road miles south of Fairbanks in Kosilof, Alaska. Feel free to stop me at any time if you have questions. We'll just go from there. This is an introductory slide. It shows one of the other boats in the project. And on the horizon, you can see a bunch of bowhead whale blows. Basically, our project, as the title slide says, was to look at the oceanographic conditions, whale prey distributions, and whale and feeding and foraging behavior. Next slide. Broadly speaking, our project goal has been to identify the environmental conditions that promote efficient feeding and foraging by bowhead whales in the Barrow area. In addition to meeting this general goal, results from this project have improved our understanding of the shelf environment in the Western Beaufort Sea and helped provide important ground truth for numerical modeling projects. Next slide. This has been a very fun project for me. Actually, it's been a number of projects that have been strung together over the past 9 years. We first went to Barrow in 2005. As funded by National Science Foundation, and then in 2007 we were picked up by NOAA through the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, what at the time was MMS. And then the last year we've been picked up by NSF again to sort of monitor and observe oceanographic conditions in Barrow Canyon, but we've kind of kept our finger in the bowhead feeding pie all along. I'm a physical oceanographer, but kind of one of the attractive aspects of this project was it's collaborative from multi-institutions and it's interdisciplinary. We have whale biologists, biological oceanographers, I'm a physical oceanographer, marine mammal scientist, so for me it's been a lot of fun. We sampled oceanographic conditions and whale prey from about mid-August to mid-September in each of these years. And there are three kind of groups. There was the oceanography team, to which I belong, and we had two goals, one of which was to provide a context, a large-scale course context for interpreting information that was observed, say, by the short-term tagging team at very fine scales. So we sample in a very broad area, and then the short-term tagging team is sampling in a very narrow area, and that our large-scale stuff helps interpret what they see in a very small scale. And then the aerial team also provides kind of a large-scale context. It tells us where bowhead whales are observed, and we can then relate that to both the large-scale and fine-scale oceanography. Next slide, please. This slide is provided by Lori Quakenbush and John Sitta at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and actually we've updated this slide a little bit more, and you'll see kind of the updated version in the bowhead whale calendar. But basically, it shows a schematic of the migratory routes that the bowhead whales take over the course of the year. They winter in the Bering Sea, which is the kind of the red area in the lower left-hand corner of the slide. And roughly about April, they start migrating northward and along the kind of the yellow arrow track. And they, at this time, the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea are ice covered, but the ice is fractured, and that allows the bowhead whales to come to the surface to breathe. They head to Amundsen Gulf, where they spend roughly June, July, August feeding, and then in September or so, they start their westward return migration to back to the Bering Sea. They arrive in Barrow, in the Barrow area, say September and October, and as they migrate westward, they are hunted in Kaktovik, Nuiksit, Barrow, and Wainwright. Actually, there's a spring whale whaling in each of those villages also. Wainwright and Barrow hunt in the spring and in the fall. Kaktovik, Nuiksit only hunt in the fall. And then Gamble and Sabunga also hunt bowheads. So on the westward migration, they pass Barrow in roughly September and October, and then cross the Chukchi Sea to the Chukotkin, the Siberian coast there, the Russian coast, where they feed on krill, and then pass again through Bering Strait, maybe, say, in December or January, and return to the Bering Sea. Next slide, please. So what do bowheads eat? Well, in the Amundsen Gulf, their primary prey is copepods. And you see a picture of a copepod in the top panel there. They're fairly small, but they have a large, highly caloric oil sac. Krill have a smaller oil sac, but they're a little bit larger. And krill, the source of krill is the Bering Sea. And the krill are abducted by currents northward into the Chukchi Sea to Barrow and to the Chukotka, the Siberian coast. The primary food in the eastern Beaufort in Amundsen Gulf is copepods. Elsewhere, the primary food is krill. This bottom picture, you'll see this again a little later, is a bowhead stomach. It's just chock-a-block full of krill. If you are familiar with those kind of big exercise balls, that's about the size of that, maybe a little bigger. You can see a person's hand on the right side of that picture. And there's some boots at the top of the picture. It provides a little bit of scale. I'll stop for a minute and see if anyone has any questions. I'll turn off my talk.
Yeah, there was a question from Justin in the chat box. He's asking, why is it that whales trend towards Russia in the fall versus taking the more direct route along the Alaskan coast? And Julia thought maybe, is it about the weather being too bad closer to Alaska? Or Joanna's asking, is it currents?
Well, actually, it's food. I had a colleague, Sue Moore at NOAA. She told me a number of years ago to think of bowhead whales like moose. Basically, they go from grazing ground to grazing ground, and the reason they go to Chukotka in the fall is because there's food there. There's a lot of krill there. There actually isn't very much krill along the eastern coast of Alaska, along that yellow arrow there. They find very little food from, say, Wales to Wainwright. And part of the reason for that is that the current there is fairly fresh, relatively fresh water, less salty. And krill don't like the less salty water. They tend to be found in the saltier water. And that current is most pronounced in the fall. So, and actually we'll see a little later in the presentation here why we don't see, in fact, we don't see krill in that coastal, freshwater coastal current. So basically they're going from place to place where they typically find food at that particular time of year. So there's a good reason for where they are, when they're there, and the reasons for why they're at these different places at different times. And basically it boils down to there's food there at those particular times. Any other questions?
Looks like Justin's typing at the moment, so let me just see if he's got a question there. What's the depth range of the whales, he's asking?
Okay, good question. In Amundsen Gulf, that's probably one of the deeper places where they hang out, many hundreds of meters, but the typical deep dive depth in Amundsen Gulf, or the most common deep dive depth, is to between 40 and 60 meters. And that's in an area where the water depth is over 200 to 300 meters. And the reason why they go to that depth is that is a stratification layer. And at that, and we presume at that stratification layer, they are finding zooplankton, probably copepods. A little later in the summer, they move up onto the shelf in, say, July, August, and September. And the reason for that is that upwelling winds start to pick up at that time, and they move, the upwelling winds move the zooplankton onto the shallow shelf, and then we see during July and August their dive depths are 10, 20, and 30 meters. And that kind of nicely aligns with kind of the meteorological thing, the upwelling winds. In everywhere else, the Chukchi is fairly shallow, less than 50 meters for the most part, and Barrow, they feed on the shelf, generally less than 20 meters depth. In their wintering grounds in the Bering Sea, the dive depths are actually somewhat deeper. They dive right down to the bottom on the shelf, down to, say, 80 meters or 100 meters or so. And the reason why they're diving down there is they're finding, probably finding krill. We can We inferred the presence of krill both from the dive depths and from the temperature of the water at that depth, which is just a little above freezing in wintertime. And that fact that that water is a little bit warmer than the surrounding water is a clue that tells us that water is coming from the deeper part of the Bering Sea where krill originate. So those are all very good questions. And that kind of points to how we tease out aspects of their life history, from both where they are, how deep they're diving, and how deep they're diving at different times of the year. So again, that all leads to that concept where they're following food.
Thanks, Steve. I know Carol was waiting to ask a question, so Carol, go ahead and ask if you'd like.
Hi, thanks. Two questions. Are the whales hunted when they're off the Russian coast in the fall? And the other question was the winter range. I guess then there are enough polynyas in the Bering Sea for them to survive. I thought that was all ice covered in the winter. Thanks.
And Steve, if you're talking, go ahead and press that talk button.
Oh yeah, I goofed. Yeah, they are hunted on the Russian coast. I'm not sure that they have as extensive hunting as occurs in Barrow, Wainwright, New Ipswich, and Kotovik. There might be a link in on the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management website, and I provide that link later on in the presentation. The wintering grounds, actually they're more to the west of that pink area. But yes, the Bering Shelf is largely ice covered in the winter, but the ice is unconsolidated. Lots of breaks. So they have no trouble finding breeding spaces.
Great. Thanks, Steve. So I'm going to jump to the slide I think you are heading to next.
Roger that. All right. One of the ways we, because we can't follow krill easily from a boat, it's also very difficult to catch them in nets, we use another tool, a numerical circulation model, to kind of figure out where we might find krill and the pathways by which krill make their way from the Bering Sea to the Arctic. And there's a paper written by a guy named Leo Berline in 2008, and he was part of the early Bowhead project. And he used this numerical model of a colleague of mine, Vislav Maslowski, who's down at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And basically, you feed the model with digital krill, and you follow the progression of each of those digital krill in time. And you can then create a trajectory for each individual krill, and there are many, I can't remember how many particular ones are in here, roughly 1,000, something like that. And then you just run the model for however many days, a year or so, and you can, it gives you two different perspectives. If you put the digital krill in the surface waters, you get one kind of trajectory. And if you put them in the bottom, at the very bottom, and follow them, you get a sort of a different ensemble of trajectories. This particular run, and actually kind of the other interesting thing is we can do this for different years because the wind conditions, which are the primary drivers of currents in this region and the ocean as a whole, change from year to year. And so if we looked at a different year, and I don't remember what year is this particular one, I guess it's 97. If we looked at, say, 2002, for example, we'd get somewhat different trajectories and whatever year we look at. But if you do this multiple times, you can get kind of a statistical sense of where krill are most likely to be found and at what times of the year you're going to find them there. Next slide, please. All right, this is our boat that we've used for 8 of the 9 years there. This is the RV Annika Marie. It's about 44 feet long. It has a draft of about 4 feet, and it's a very good platform for what we do. We're basically able to get right up to the beach, and that's a capability that this vessel has over the much larger oceanographic vessels that are very uncomfortable getting into shallow waters. For example, the Healy, which is the United States Coast Guard icebreaker, it doesn't like to get any shallower than about 20 meters, and in certain places that may be many, many miles from shore. You can get some intermediate vessels that might come in a little closer, but basically we can nose right up on the beach with this boat. And like I say, it's a good platform for what we do. Next slide, please. This is our oceanographic team. Dr. Karen Ashton is in the top left-hand panel. She's from Woods Hole. She's the lead investigator for our project. Phil Alatalo is a technician from Woods Hole. Bob Campbell in the lower left panel is from University of Rhode Island. Bob's a zooplankton guy. And then Bill Copland, the skipper, is in the plaid shirt in the lower panel, and I'm the guy in the Carhartt coat dumping line into a bucket. The right bottom right panel shows our sample transects for years 2005 to 2010. We occupied different lines in different years, but we've settled on the black lines. So you can see three black lines there, one trending from Point Barrow to the northwest across Barrow Canyon. On sort of to the right-hand side, there's one going to the northeast off the shelf, the shallow shelf into the deeper waters of Barrow Canyon. Then there's kind of a dogleg one between the two black ones. So those three lines, they're number 2, 4, and 6 in our nomenclature, are the ones we've been occupying every year since 2007. Well, we've occupied them every year, but since 2007, those are the only lines we typically occupy. Next slide, please. The top picture on the left shows one of the instruments that we deploy from the boat. It's called an Acrobat. It's a towed vehicle. It looks a little bit like an airplane, and it's instrumented with 6 sensors. And the colored panels below the Acrobat picture show the properties that are measured by those sensors. There's salinity, temperature, optical backscatter, in other words, how much stuff is in the water, chlorophyll fluorescence, and CDOM, which is an organic, dissolved organic material. And the 6th sensor is the pressure sensor, which is essentially depth. So as this towed vehicle flies up and down through the water column, it's sampling at a very high rate, something like 16 times a second, and we can plot the sample from the measurements from each of these sensors to give us a profile of the properties in the water column as we motor along, in this case, the little red line in the lower panel, the map panel. So we're crossing Barrow Canyon here, and if we look at the salinity panel in the upper left there, you can see that there's a gradient with depth of salinity, and if we move to temperature, you can see there's a vertical gradient and also a lateral gradient. The warmest water is near the coast, and the left-hand side of this, each of those plots is Barrow or Point Barrow, and the right-hand side is further offshore on the other side of Barrow Canyon. And you can sort of see that temperature and salinity are inversely related in the upper 30 meters here, whatever is being sampled by the Acrobat. Near the coast, there's a little bit of optical backscatter. So when we're in shallower water, you'd expect more suspended sediments, and that's exactly what it's telling us. So you can see the black, meaning that water is really clear. The fluorescence one, the middle one on the right-hand side, kind of the light blue is indicating that there's more chlorophyll, more algae in the water, and that kind of, you can sort of imagine it following the salinity, the green salinity profile or the yellow salinity profile. And then the last one, CDOM, chromophoric dissolved organic material. The highest concentration there is right on the left-hand side. And a lot of the organic material is stuff being washed off the tundra coming into the oceans. And that's why you see that little signal there. So the Acrobat, because we only have a certain amount of cable on the winch, gets down to about 50 meters. In this case, it's only going down to about 30 meters. But so we generally can't get the instrument to fly deeper than about 50 meters. But in Barrow Canyon, the depths we encounter are better than 100 meters, and we need a way of measuring the properties in those deeper waters, and we use another instrument package called the CTD, a conductivity temperature depth recorder, and its picture is the top right-hand side of the panel, and it's in a little stainless steel cage, and it to protect the instruments. And so the little color plot below it is of temperature, and you'll see some little carrots across the top of the page, or atop the plot, the little inverted V's there. Those show the locations at which we deploy the CTD. The CTD is hooked to a wire that runs to a winch, and we lower it to the bottom, and it samples at 4 times a second as it's going down, and then we take that information, and along with the Acrobat information, we throw it into a computer contouring program, and it produces these nice little plots of temperature and salinity and fluorescence. What's interesting about this particular plot of temperature is, again, on the left side, left-hand side of the plot, that's barrow, and you see this very warm water. It's better than 6C. And then on the right-hand side, or at depth, you see the very cold water, which is colder than minus 1, and that's there all year round, that very cold water. And we're going to return to this distribution a little later in the presentation. Next slide, please.
Steve, can you just reiterate what or where Barrow Canyon is?
Sure. Look at on the Acrobat half of the slide, there's a little map down at the bottom, and there's a red line. You see a bunch of blue lines there. Those are isobaths, lines of constant depth. So right next to the coast there, trending from southwest to northeast, you can see the lines are bunched together. So we're going from shallow to deep as we move across or out that red line. On the far side of the canyon, it's about 50 meters deep, right at the left end of the red line. Somewhere right in the middle of the red line there, it's about 140 meters deep. And at the right-hand edge of the line, it runs from about 10 meters deep, and it gets deep pretty quick. And if you look at the plot underneath the CTD, you can, unfortunately, the orientation is backwards from the line itself, but you can see the barrow side, in this case, is on the left-hand side. The bathymetry is relatively steep. It falls off quickly. And then on the opposite side, the western side, which is the right-hand side of the plot, it's the bottom just a little shallower and not so steep. So does that work?
That makes perfect sense. Thank you. Absolutely.
Okay, some of the other things we do from the Annika Marie is we tow nets to get zooplankton. We also tend to find some small fish in there and other things if the nets drag along the bottom. And from multiple years of occupying stations on the shelf and in the canyon and within the lagoon, we can create a little picture that shows how conditions or catches change from year to year in each of these domains and under different wind conditions. And the particular kind of three-dimensional bar plot that's shown there, it says inactive, shelf active. We'll come back to this in a little bit, but that refers to whether the krill trap is active or inactive. And the active-inactive mode of the krill trap is associated with what the winds are doing. And typically, if the winds are from the east, which is the prevailing wind direction, the krill trap is not active, although we're putting krill on the shelf. We have to wait till the winds turn off and the system stabilizes for the krill to be retained on the shelf. And we have a slide coming up that addresses that a little more in detail and with some visual help. On the right-hand side, it shows a current meter mooring, a shallow current meter mooring, one that we deploy in typically less than about 20 meters of water. And it's built out of, in this case, a fiberglass frame. Other people build them out of steel or aluminum frames or some other plastic frames. It has a number of instruments on there. And just below the W on shallow, you can kind of see a white cylinder. That's an acoustic recorder. It listens for marine mammal vocalizations. Could be whales, could be seals, walrus, whatever. Just below that and to the right, you see a blue thing with a bunch of orange dots. That's called an acoustic Doppler current profiler. It's an ADCP in shorthand. It's a current meter. And each of those four orange dots is an acoustic transducer. It sends out an acoustic pulse, and because they're all oriented in different directions, There's an onboard computer that looks at the Doppler shift of the return acoustic signal and is able to build a profile throughout the water column of what the current velocities are. That is both the speed of the current and the direction of the current. To the right of that, there's kind of a silver metal thing. That's a, we call them microcats. It's a conductivity temperature sensor. In other words, it measures temperature and salinity. And so we're able to associate what the typical water mass is, the temperature salinity characteristics, with what the currents are doing. And those oftentimes change depending on current speed and direction. And then if you look to the lower left-hand side of the current of the mooring frame, you'll see a big orange ball and then a yellow cylinder. That's the release and recovery mechanism. The yellow cylinder is an acoustic release. When we want to recover this mooring from the bottom of the ocean, we send a coded signal that is received by the acoustic release, the yellow thing, and it releases the orange ball. The orange ball has a line that's secured to the frame, and the ball floats to the surface, and we drive up to it with the boat, pick up the ball, grab the line, and then wrap the line on the winch, and we haul the thing up from the bottom. And some of the information that we get from this, at least as related to the currents, is shown in the bottom map in the lower right-hand corner. And there are four little diamonds, and you see a bunch of little colored sticks originating from the four diamonds. Each of those diamonds is a mooring location, and the kind of the bullseye with some other colored sticks is a windrose. So and I believe each of the concentric circles is 2 meters a second. So the first innermost is winds of 2 meters a second, then 4 meters a second, then 6 meters a second. So if you double that, you get roughly the wind speed in knots. So that's 4 knots. 4, 8 knots and 12 knots, roughly speaking. So you can see that when winds are blowing out of the east towards the west, the currents are basically to the west on the shallow shelf. And those the three kind of grouped together are less than 20 meters. And then there's one at the top of the page, which is at about 100 meters. You can see even though the winds are blowing from the east toward the west, the currents are from the southwest to the northeast. And in order to reverse those currents at that deeper location, we need to have winds from the east blow for a few days. Any questions at the moment?
It doesn't look like it. I think you're okay.
Okay, let's move to the next one. So this is the kind of assembly of a deep water year-round mooring. Again, you can kind of see in the top panel, top left-hand side, we've got the ADCP, the little white-barreled thing with the blue and orange top. The thing I'm holding is an external battery pack, an extra battery pack for the ADCP because it's got to stay out for a year. And then the flotation is the big orange thing, the buoy. Going to the right, you see our anchor chain, and we have to use anchor chain. Typically, on a large oceanographic vessel, you'll use railroad wheels as anchors. Railroad wheels weigh 700-800 pounds to 1,000 pounds, depending. But we have to. None of us individually or collectively can pick up a railroad wheel and move it to the our little boat. So we have to build our anchor from chunks of chain, about 60-pound chunks of chain, and then we chain all the big chains together with a smaller chain, and that's our anchor. And like I say, we have to move all that by hand. So then in the bottom panel, we attach one of these conductivity temperature sensors, the thing that measures temperature and salinity, to the outside of the buoy, and then we have our acoustic releases, and you'll notice there are two of those little yellow cylinders there, and we put two of them on the deep water moorings in case one doesn't work. And even so, things don't always work. You have to be prepared for losing all of this instrumentation anytime you put it in the water, particularly in Arctic and Antarctic regions. It's just a hostile environment for instrumentation. And we throw it in the water. Next slide. And the picture on the left shows what one of these things looks like when it's deployed. So in our case, we put out these things. If you look at the map, there's a little blue oval and there's a blue dot, a blue asterisk on the left side of the oval and a red asterisk on the right side of the oval. Actually, Lisa was out for a recovery of the mooring where the red dot is, and she has a very nice little video of our anticipatory mood on deck, trying to get this thing back. All told, this thing is worth about $45,000. The acoustic releases, this is a little more than that. Each of those acoustic releases is about $10,000. The microcat's about $5,000 or $6,000. The flotation itself is about $6,000. The ADCP is about $23,000. So we're up to $25,000, we're up to $55,000, $56,000. When Lisa was there, we did recover a mooring, and we put out another one at roughly the same location, and when we went to recover it this year, it didn't come back. So I lost it. Like I say, there's something like $50,000 of equipment laying on the bottom someplace. Even though there were twin releases, we weren't able to communicate with either one, and oh well, that's the way it goes. So, here's a better picture of Barrow Canyon. Going back to a question a few slides ago, you can see the isobaths there, and this canyon drains the eastern Chukchi Shelf. So there's a big current that runs through this canyon into the Arctic Ocean proper. And you can see from the isobaths that it gets fairly deep fairly quickly. We're out over 3,000 meters there in the upper right-hand corner of that map. That's about 10,000 feet, quite deep, plenty deep. Next slide, please. All right, so now we're going to look at some of the results from those two moorings. And the West Barrow Canyon mooring, the very top picture comes from the ADCP. As I mentioned earlier, some acoustic pulses are transmitted there. And if we look at the backscatter, how much of that transmitted pulse is reflected and received by the ADCP, we see that we get this very kind of quasi-sinusoidal, this up and down motion over the course of the day. And if you look closely at the plot, you'll see some vertical dotted lines. Those are celestial midnight of each day. And the numbers below are the day numbers. So this is, runs roughly from the 10th of September to the 20th of September 2010. And so you have this very nice up and down motion. And what that is krill moving up and down in the water column. They go down at depth during the daytime to the dark, where it's dark near the bottom, to avoid visual predators. And at night, they go up to the surface to feed on small zooplankton and algae. And if you compare that with the trace on the upper panel on the East Barrow Canyon side of the plot, you'll see that there aren't any of these very nice up and down motions. You just kind of see this noise. And what that tells us is that we see krill on the west side of Barrow Canyon, but we don't see krill on the eastern side of the Barrow Canyon. So now let's skip down to the next plots beneath each of these color plots, and you'll see that the temperature plot on the west side for these 10 days, and in fact, we could put a year-long record there, and it would look just like this. It's cold, basically below zero all year round at 65 meters depth. It's just very cold all year round. And it's relatively salty, fairly constant at near 33 parts per thousand. Let's contrast that to the mooring on the east side. And that's, if you look at the color plots in the middle there, you can see the red little arrow. That's the location of the mooring, location and depth of that mooring. And it's much warmer there. It's above freezing. It runs, at least at this time of the year, like between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius. And the salinity is lower. It's about 31. And if you remember earlier, someone had the question about, well, why don't krill move up the east side along the Alaska coast? As I mentioned, it had to do with the temperature salinity characteristics of the water. And these two moorings provide confirmation of that, showing that we don't see this behavior in the, we don't see this up and down diel vertical migration behavior in the East Barrow Canyon mooring information, but we do see it in the Western Barrow Canyon. So krill are not associated with warm fresh water, but they are associated with cold salty water. So we know, and then we can go back and see how they might get there. So next slide, please. So we use yet some other bits of information to help piece together this feeding story, and some handy visual aids are satellite imagery. And in the left top-hand panel, we see a MODIS satellite image. I've tweaked the colors a little bit to make the sediment plume stand out a little bit, but there's this kind of greenish-brown near-shore sediment plume that extends from the east side of the, from the right side of the plot, and it's moving around Point Barrow to flow to the southwest under these very strong winds, these 7.3 meter per second, that's like 15 knot winds. So the winds just push the sediment from the shallow shelf around back into the deep waters of Barrow Canyon. And there are krill, we use this sediment as a tracer for krill, which we can't see. And so if krill are in this water, they too are pushed from east to west off the shelf back into Barrow Canyon. And if we look below that, there's a plot that has three little boxes. From aerial surveys, if we look at only those aerial surveys that occur during winds, strong winds from the east, we only see, and this is, occurs over, this is roughly a 30-year period from 1982 to 2009, I think. Only three groups of whales were observed on the shelf during these strong east wind conditions. In contrast, if we look at, use the satellite to show us, give us a clue what the circulation is on the shelf and in Barrow Canyon when winds are weaker, and they can be from any direction as long as they're less than roughly 5 meters per second or about 10 knots. And here, instead of using sediment, suspended sediments as a tracer, we're using floating sea ice. And you can kind of see this sea ice band that's parallel to the eastern coast of Alaska, and it's roughly midway between the red line and the coast. Well, that kind of convergent area, that grouping of sort of quasi-linear grouping of the floating sea ice is about the 20-meter ice bath. And historically, what's interesting about that historically is that the Yankee whalers would look along the 10-fathom curve. And the 10-fathom curve is this, roughly the same thing as the 20-meter ice bath. And so here we have visual evidence that there's a convergence area. And convergence is important in an ecological sense, in an oceanographic sense, because if it can converge ice, well, if they're krill, they're also the krill tend to be converged or aggregated along this 10-fathom curve or 20-meter ice bath. And then, so if we then go back in the historical record of all the aerial surveys for 1982 to 2009, and we plot the locations of bowhead whales when winds are weak, we see a big difference. And you can see all the little blue diamonds. So the bowhead whales come onto the shelf because, at that time, because there's krill available. The krill tend to stay on the shelf in a manner and in a distribution that's somewhat akin to what that sea ice satellite image shows. Next slide, please. So here's the krill trap. And so we've synthesized a lot of information. We've taken satellite imagery. We've taken aerial surveys of bowhead whales. We've taken oceanography. We've taken wind records, meteorology, and looked at how all these things relate to one another. And we developed what's called a conceptual model of how this feeding hotspot at Barrow comes about. So on the left-hand panel, when winds are from the east, the big red, fat red arrow, it upwells krill from the deeper water. Remember that cold winter water, and that's deep. It brings them up onto the shelf, but as the suspended sediment slide showed, even though we put krill up onto the shelf, they get carried right back off into Barrow Canyon again. So in order to trap these krill on the shelf, the winds have to turn off. They have to relax. And the current then comes back near the shelf, and it traps, or near the Chukchi Coast, near the edge of Barrow Canyon, and the krill end up being trapped on the shelf, that little red area on the right-hand map. Next slide, please.
Steve, Julia, there's a couple of questions that were going by about krill. Can they swim or do they go by the currents? And Lisa explained that it was the currents that were moving them. And then Julia's wondering how they change depth from that day to night, as you were mentioning. So Lisa has just put not enough swim power to drive themselves, so they follow the currents like they're on a conveyor belt. But can you explain a little bit more? I'm going to jump back to that picture on the left where they're different in the day and night.
Sure. They have, as Lisa pointed out, they have a hard time swimming. They can swim, but most of their lateral motion is due to the currents. So they're just carried with the currents. However, over the course of the day, they have a behavioral response to light and dark. And the behavioral response is that during daylight, they go down to depth, very near the bottom, to avoid visual predators. The deeper we go in the water, the more attenuated the light is, so they're safer down near the bottom. And in fact, we find that out. We typically, if we catch krill, if we can get a net very near the bottom, we tend to be more successful catching krill in the daytime. And then at night, because daylight goes away, they can then go to the surface with less chance of getting eaten by fish, for example. And you can see this motion. The backscatter is highest at midnight, centered on those vertical dotted lines. So they've come to the surface to feed, to graze on other small microzooplankton, for example. And actually, that's a good point. This behavioral response, that is moving vertically in the water column, going to depth during the daytime, is the other part of the equation that makes that puts them in a puts a lot of krill in a small area. They're all trying to get near the bottom to hide. So now you have krill, instead of dispersed through 20 meters of water, they're dispersed through 1 meter of water, one meter layer, something like that. And so if a bowhead whale during the daytime is cruising along the bottom, he's finding, that's where he's going to find the krill. They're down near the bottom hiding out, but that's where the whales go to find them. And it's and they're very concentrated, and hence we get that picture of the stomach just being jammed full of krill, for example.
We'll go to that picture in just a second. Amanda was also asking, is it possible to field check the krill model, or are all the models using proxies?
That's also a good question. I have a graduate student who is using ADCPs. We can, as you can see in this in the current slide at the top, when krill are present, we have this nice backscatter signal, this sinusoidal daily signal. And we can go on the shelf in 10 or 20 meters of water, and we see the same behavior. When there's east winds, there happens to be fewer of these nice or the, I should say, the magnitude, the strength of these diurnal vertical migration signals is much weaker than occur when we turn off the winds, when winds are weak. And so we indirectly can tell that krill are more prevalent when the winds turn off. And the aerial survey stuff shows us that whales are more prevalent when the winds turn off. So all of these things are consistent with this conceptual model.
Perfect. Thanks, Steve. And just to let everybody know, we're coming towards Steve's last few slides, and we can try and do a couple minutes for questions, but we're getting towards the hour. This is great. Steve, I'm going to turn to that slide with the lovely photo you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, this is courtesy of Craig George, a great guy up at North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management. And you can see this, this is a bowhead stomach of a whale landed at Barrow. And at the right-hand side, you can see a gloved hand. And at the very top of the slide, you can see a pair of boots. So it gives you a sense of the scale. But that is just totally full with krill. And actually, I didn't show one, a stomach from Koktovik for comparison. But in Koktovik, that's closer to the Canadian Beaufort. And the whale stomachs there more often are filled with copepods. And it looks a little different, but still the same concept. They're just chock-a-block full of zooplankton. Next slide, please. And what's interesting over, say, the last 5 to 10 years is funding agencies for scientific research in all disciplines has sort of encouraged scientists to devote greater effort to conveying their research to lay audiences. And in our case, we synthesized a lot of what is known, ongoing and previously funded research with respect to the bowhead whale, and we put that in a calendar format. And I think Lisa has a calendar and Sarah has a calendar. We printed off about 900 of these things, distributed most of them across the North Slope Borough. After all, that's where whaling occurs, and the bowhead is a cultural icon up there. And it summarized, like I say, some of the traditional knowledge and sort of Western science type stuff. And I think Sarah made available a PDF of this that you can look at it in more detail. Feel free to print off the PDF. Here in this particular slide, you can see a number of the contributing scientists here, and the acknowledgments include local people from Barrow. But it's a very colorful, it was a well-received calendar. One of our colleagues, Kate Stafford, suggested that we put one of those little audio chips in the calendar, and that's in the September one, and there's a little button there, and you could push the button and hear a bowhead vocalization. And kind of one of the funny things was, as I, in packing these things up, they were all shrink-wrapped, and so you'd have like 40 calendars in a box, and if someone dropped the box, you'd have many of these things going off, and it's this box of cacophony of bowhead calls. At any rate, next slide. And finally, yet another outreach product. We were able to secure funding for the University of Alaska Museum of the North to produce a digital animation of a year in the life of the bowhead whale, and it takes as its kind of straw man storyboard the content from the calendar. And we're about a year, not quite a year and a half, a little more than a year into the project, and Roger Topp, who's the producer of the film at the museum, and Hannah Foss, an animator, have put together a little blog, and the address for that blog, arcticcurrents.wordpress.com. It's a great blog. It tells how they are building this movie. Very, very interesting for me. I had no idea, but I'm just amazingly impressed with the stuff that they're putting out. Hannah's an undergraduate student, interestingly enough. She had an internship down at Pixar, so she's been doing the digital animation. It's just truly amazing. And if things work out, Sarah's going to show you a little teaser clip. I don't know, it's about a minute or a minute and a half, just showing, like I say, some of the stuff they've done.
Yeah.
Very, very amazing stuff. And finally, the other thing I would like to point out about this film, it's going to be recorded in three languages, Inupiat, St. Lawrence Island, Yupik, and English. Inupiat and St. Lawrence Island, Yupik, because those are the languages of the people here in Alaska that whale. And there we go. We're really looking forward to this. Everyone, the people who funded this are really happy with the progress that's been made on the film, and I'm amazed. I've had a lot of fun working with these guys.
Yeah, this is Sarah. I'll jump in, and as we've been talking, I believe the teaser film I'll show right now has been buffering for everyone. So I'll press play here, and if it isn't coming out well for you, you might take a minute and just see if it comes through. But it should work pretty well, and it's also one of the resources within our course website. You can check it out there, too. So I'm going to press play here and see if we can all take a quick look. Perfect. So mine just wrapped up here. People are just commenting, so looks like people did get to see it. Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. Okay, Carol, you said it was a little slow. It is available on our group site, and I can point that out a little bit more for folks. Yeah, I'm really excited about this project as well. So I'm going to turn it back over to Steve and go to your resource slide here.
Well, actually, one thing I want to mention about this you know, some of your kids might not be science-oriented in your classroom, but as both the calendar and the film indicate, people who are artistically inclined, it's great, at least from my perspective, to work with people with these talents to convey what we do. You know, we have jargon, and when we sit down and try to hash out how to present this stuff, it's very important to have people who can write well, create a narrative, and create a visual product. So there's a lot of there are a lot of opportunities for people who maybe aren't science types but are artists. And more broadly, I mean, in order for us to do what we do on a boat, we need people. We need people who are boat savvy, for example. On very large boats, you need to have cooks. You need to have people who work the deck. You need to have mechanics to make sure the engines are running. So it takes a very broad range of skill sets, not only scientific, but very practical to make the the pursuit of science happen. So, you know, your classrooms have kids with many, many different talents, and you know, there's room for all of them. I guess final slide. So here are a bunch of websites that I use with greater or lesser regularity. The top one is the Arctic Mosaic. I think I sent out a response to, was it Janine? That's very cool. I use this all the time to just kind of keep tabs on what's happening in the Arctic. The next one, the NOAA site, you can create gridded maps of sea level pressure, wind fields for anywhere in the world. Ocean Color shows is another NASA site that you can look at what the chlorophyll distribution is in the oceans. Tides, if you want to find the tides for anywhere in the country and many places in the world. ARH, NOAA.gov is another weather type site. LISA's site. Weather Underground is what I use when I'm in Barrow for quick and dirty monitoring of what wind speed and direction are. And Weather Underground, you can get it for pretty much anywhere. Kind of an interesting site is the HF radar. There are some radar sites up in the Barrow area that allow the visualization of surface currents. It's kind of an interesting little site. The next one, the NAME, the NPS-EDU, that's a site that covers the numerical model. We saw a couple slides with numerical model output. There are some resources there. Real Climate, a number of you have been interested in climate change. This is a good site. And finally, the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife. This is an excellent, excellent site for research on bowhead whales, walrus, many of the subsistence use species on the North Slope. Very good site. I urge you all to check it out. They have little descriptive bits, and they also have links to the original scientific publications upon which the descriptive material is based. And I think that wraps it up for me.
Steve, that was great. Thank you so much for that. I had just put in the chat box that folks are welcome to ask some questions if they have them. So if you want to type questions into the chat box, go right ahead. If you want to ask a question live, you can sort of raise your hand with that icon, and I'll call on you when we have a second. And Julia had a question earlier, and it was, any sign of decrease in krill due to climate change?
We can't tease that out yet. it's so variable from year to year. It's hard to pull out a trend right now. I mean, we've been there 9 years, and every year is different. It's in terms of the krill. It's just, we can't tell. Oh, by the way, if you're interested in being put on the Arctic Currents blog update list, so send me your email address. Just send me an email. I think my email is on the introductory slide of the program, and I'll add you to the distribution list. So you'll get a notification when the next blog entry comes out. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I really enjoy reading it and sort of seeing the science from the perspective of the tech side of how you're going to convey it to that art form like you were talking about earlier. Lots of people are thanking you for the great presentation there in the chat box. So I think it looks like folks are sort of ready to wrap up on the hour here or a little past. And Steve, I got to say thanks so much for your presentation. It was absolutely wonderful. I'll be making sure that this presentation becomes an archive in the next couple of days so folks can check it out. And one quick question from Lisa, as people are signing off if they've got to go. Is it safe to say that all your data combines with other researchers to help provide a base of what's going on so eventually researchers can figure out if global warming is affecting krill or other organisms?
It might be possible at some point in the future. right, like I say, we have 9 years of data. We are funded for one more year. We're debating whether to resubmit for an additional 5 years. We're leaning that way. The longer record you have, the easier it is, or it increases your ability to tease out longer signals. I mean, in the extreme, if you only had 1 year of information on the krill, there's no way that you could conceivably tell how krill is responding to, or whether it is in fact influenced by climate change. You need a really, really long record. So there we go. We won't know for a while.
Perfect. Yeah, we hope you, if you want to get that funding, we hope you do. So thanks for working with Polartrek over this long time and taking Lisa up there. And we really look forward to Lisa's presentation next week on how she brings this kind of stuff into the classroom. People were really curious during your presentation on how they can use it. So thanks so much, and thanks to everybody for participating, and we'll send you off. Have a great evening, and we'll talk to a lot of you next week. Thanks again, Steve.
Okay, I'm out.
All right, take care.